Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mid-Atlantic Championship Podcast. I'm Mike Sempervivi. This is a special episode of the program. If you're listening to this when the show drops, you know it's a big holiday week, one which my co-host and I, Roman Gomez, had intended on taking off. And then the great Brian Last went and dropped the two-episode 605 Super Podcast, talking all about the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. And man, I got a bunch of feelings. As some of you may know, I'm a proud member of the voting committee. It's one of my favorite times a year. It's an excuse to go back into history, like we need one around here, and banter about all the merits of a person as opposed to another. That's exactly what Jim Cornette, Scott Teal, Dan Farron, Steve Ogilvie, Jeff Bowdrin, Pete Lederberg, Kurt Brown, Alan Blackstock, Marty Goldstein, Fredo Esparza, Roy Lucier, Brian and I did on those shows. And all that talking that was done, with all of the writing and opinions that the wrestling landscape at large had done about the awards, it seemed to me that Jim Crockett Sr.'s induction kind of went by with a little fanfare. And considering we do a show about Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, which only exists because of him, I thought maybe I should be the one that reads the bio, or at the very least tries to. And I have no idea how this is going to turn out, but I had to give it a shot anyway. To be honest, if you're subscribing to a podcast that goes back into time and adds context to a pro wrestling show that aired damn near 40 years ago, I reckon you might be kind of a forgiving group if this whole thing goes sideways. So, if it does, or if it doesn't, or if you just want to get a hold of us about something else, you can do that through our social media. I'd love to hear from you. Twitter and Facebook both, Mid-Atlantic Pod. At both of those places, you can keep updated on the show, as well as check out features like On This Day and JCP TV History and hashtag Everyday Arn. Don't worry, next week we will be back to reviewing shows, but for now, let's take a little bit of a look at Big Jim. James Allen Crockett was born on June 2, 1909 in Bristol, Virginia. He overcame poverty in his youth to become the owner of both a restaurant and a theater of the rural town by the time he was 25 years old. Along with business partner Pete Moore, Crockett named his business the Southeastern Corporation and continued to look for different ways to expand his operations. One of those ways was professional wrestling. In 1931, fascinated by Strangler Lewis, Joe Stecker, and other stars he watched while growing up, Crockett began promoting the sport locally around Bristol with the help of his brothers. He would slowly branch out, going town to town, getting as far west as 20 miles into Kingsport, Tennessee. In 1933, Crockett would move to Greensboro, North Carolina, buying an old warehouse that he'd convert into a venue and rename the arena. He began promoting dance nights featuring big band music, touring groups, and boxing cards. And, of course, there was pro wrestling, too. Crockett began promoting the sport at its new building on December 20th, 1933. Crockett took the reins of the city over from Ramon Atkins, a former golf pro who had succeeded George Kazana in the town. According to research of newspaper accounts, results for that night listed Nick Bozinas beating Mike Colonis in 38 minutes, while Jim Heslin defeated Gus Knothead Pappas. Newspaper reports announced that the building was, quote, more than half full, and portions of the ticket sales from the event went to the benevolent organization, the Empty Stocking Fund. The fund was created in 1927 by Greensboro Daily News editor A.L. Stockton and became a charity that the Crockett family would continue to support for decades afterwards. Around the same time in 1933, a man by the name of John Francis Irish Horan began promoting wrestling in Charlotte. Horan would run shows featuring primarily light heavyweights, but not being able to follow through on grandiose claims of talent that he could bring in, and putting on cards that were less than stellar and featuring many substitutions, Horan's efforts would come to a spectacular end when local newspaper reporters at the Charlotte Observer would discover that his backstory was mostly made up, and on May 28, 1934, the North Carolina Athletic Commission would officially ban Horan from ever promoting in the state again. As an aside, Horan would go on to achieve a bit of fame as the public address announcer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway until his death on May 2, 1958, including being credited as the first person to announce, "Gentlemen, start your engines." Leaving a vacuum in the city, it was noted by the Charlotte Observer sports editor Jake Wade that the Athletic Commission President C.W. Stockard, who happened to be from Greensboro, quote, thinks highly of Jim Crockett, the Greensboro MAP promoter, and apparently believes that his wrestling, as is being conducted there, is all okay. Crockett had been promoting Greensboro alongside Bill Lewis, real name James Arthur Whitfield. Lewis was a former professional wrestler who had been known as Captain Bluebeard. He was outgoing and served as the perfect frontman for the product. Lewis had publicly announced their intentions of running the city on June 12, 1934, with a required announcement in the papers. A week later, the two were denied at a commission hearing, and instead, the license for the city ended up in the hands of Horn's former underling, Joe Williamson. Williamson first announced he was running Charlotte the next month on July 9th, before pushing his initial date back to July 16th. But on July 10th, Williamson made the announcement he'd be canceling the event, and it took no time at all for Crockett and Lewis to come swooping back in. They had a hearing on Monday, July 16th, 1934, where Crockett was finally approved to run the city, which he had planned to do on Friday, August 10th. Unfortunately, Mother Nature didn't cooperate, and the show was then moved to Monday, August 13th, 1934, at the Charlotte Armory. That night, Marshall Blackstock beat Harry Lewis, Jim Henry, substituting for Jim Heslin, beat Lee Collins, and in the main event, former Tennessee Volunteers football player Herman Hickman beat Stanley Satowski in a 2-out-of-3 falls match. Hickman was substituting for Bill Middlecoff, a move that was quite possibly done as a way to try to spike ticket sales as the show drew near. The Charlotte Observer newspaper estimated between 800 and 1,400 fans showed up for the event. The success in Greensboro and Charlotte helped the promoter continue to expand his operations into South Carolina and as far south as Tampa, where the company began promoting in the spring of 1935 after smelling blood in the water due to the failing operation of local promoter Jim Downing. 1935 would certainly be a special and memorable year for the Crockett family. Big Jim would wed his fiancée, Elizabeth Jackson Eversole, on December 20th, and the family would take up residence in the Queen City. On January 3rd, 1939, holding firm control over three states as well as towns in Tennessee, Georgia, and Florida, Jim Crockett and Bill Lewis bought out Crockett's old partner Pete Moore for $8,000 and dissolved the Southeastern Corporation. From that moment on, they began to promote wrestling under the banner of the Bill Lewis Athletic Corporation. Crockett's successes would open the opportunity to begin running two towns a night locally about a year later. According to the Clawmaster Jim Zordani's records, the first time I was able to find Crockett running split crews looked to be on December 2, 1940, with shows in both Charlotte and 200 miles east on the coast over in Wilmington. In the main event at Charlotte's Armory, Cowboy Luttrell defeated Daniel Boone Savage while Babe Zaharias topped Bartow Hill. Meanwhile, in Wilmington's Legion Stadium, Chief Little Beaver defeated Jack Reeder while Dick Lever drew with Eddie Varig. The first time I could find three shows being run would be on April 16, 1954, and, amazingly, none of them would be in the heart of the territory. One took place in Florence, South Carolina at the Sports Arena, featuring Pat Farley against Joe Campbell, Bobby Becker against Lou Newman, and George Becker against Hans Schnabel, while the two others took place up north in Virginia. One was held at the Atlantic Rural Exposition, which featured Al Smith against Red Kirkpatrick, John Smith against Angelo Martinelli, and Betty Hawkins against June Byers. The other show was in Danville at the City Auditorium featuring Ray Gunkel defeating Don Lee, Ivan Rasputin against Steve Gobb, and Babe Zaharias against Charles Keen. Crockett would try it on a weekly basis beginning on May 8th. The company began running two shows in North Carolina in the cities of Lenoir and Lexington, with a third taking place in Spartanburg, South Carolina. The arrangement would continue for years, with Greenville and Spartanburg alternating weeks. The promotion ran three towns on back-to-back days on November 21st and 22nd, 1955. On the 21st, there were shows in Greenville, South Carolina, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Gastonia, North Carolina. On the 22nd, most of the Greenville crew went on to Columbia, South Carolina, while Winston-Salem moved on to Roanoke and Gastonia to Fayetteville. From the 1930s into the 1950s, historian Tim Hornbaker notes that Crockett was one of only five remaining promoters that had run one territory for 20 years, the others being Morris Siegel in Houston, Toots Mont in New York, Paul Bowser in Boston, and Bill Lewis, who was associated with the Crockett, in Richmond, Virginia. Speaking of promoters, on December 7, 1951, Crockett was officially welcomed in as a member of the National Wrestling Alliance. In something of an offshoot, at a meeting in Atlanta on May 2, 1953, Southeast-based promoters banded together and formed the Southern Wrestling Alliance and voted Crockett as its first president. That combination possibly included NWA promoters Crockett, Lewis, Roy Welch in Tennessee, John Kizana in Knoxville, Joe Gunter in Birmingham, Paul Jones in Atlanta, and Cowboy Luttrell in Tampa, as well as possibly Nick Gulas in Nashville, who had initially been denied NWA membership, and Fred Ward in Macon, Georgia, who worked alongside Paul Jones. I have no clue as to the membership, nor any accomplishments of this partnership amongst the Southeastern Strongmen, but one thing is for sure, that is, the Southern Tag Team title was going to become the top prize in the Carolina Territory. John and Al Smith would depart the Carolinas in August of 1953, showing up across the mountains in Nashville. After defeating Herb and Roy Welch on September 1st, the Smiths would return to Crockett Promotions and begin defending the championship trophy and the champion's ring jackets throughout the Southeast. As time went on, the championship lineage would splinter again, and according to the research listed by Jim Zordani, the last reference to the Alliance of Southern Promoters was in 1969 in Florida. Regardless of any other promoter, Crockett's business was booming. But while that was happening, he actually had to deal with the very real-life decline and the ultimate death of one of his biggest stars, Bobby Becker, one of the biggest baby faces he had, and half of the Southern Tag Team Champions, alongside his kayfabe brother George. According to the Mid-Atlantic Gateway, it was the Richmond promoter Lewis that actually gets the credit for bringing the duo into the area in 1951. Under their time with Crockett Promotions, at one point, they got so popular, they received the keys to the city of Charlotte by Mayor Victor Shaw. But unfortunately, in 1954, Becker was diagnosed with leukemia, and the illness came on incredibly fast. On November 5th, he defeated Pete Maniguoff during a match in Richmond. He was then scheduled to team with his partner George Becker against Lou Plummer and Jack O'Brien in Greenville. With no result, I'm not sure if that match ever took place. On November 8th, George would begin to team with a number of different partners, beginning with Tommy O'Toole and featuring Gino Garibaldi and Freddie Blassie. Only a few weeks later, on Thanksgiving night, November 25th, as the show would take place in Charleston, South Carolina, Bobby Becker, real name John J. Emmerling, would pass away in a New York hospital. At the time of his death, the Beckers had held the Southern Tag Team titles. 13 years Bobby's junior, Jack Witzig was chosen to be George's full-time partner, with the pair holding the titles until January in 1955, and they teamed regularly for the next 2 years. Always known as a prolific tag team territory, Crockett relied on Emil and Ernie Dusick, Chick and Leo Garibaldi, Al and Tiny Mills, Mr. Moto and Kenji Shibuya, Doc and Mike Gallagher, as well as Dickie Steinborn, Ricky Starr, Len Rossi, and many others to keep the machine moving. As the page turned into the 60s, new teams such as Jackie and Sonny Fargo, the Von Brauners, Al and Don Green, Sandy and George Scott, and Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen would keep things buzzing. In May of 1952, the Kentuckians of Grizzly Smith and Luke Brown entered the area, followed in October by the Great Bolos. Those two teams' paths began to dovetail beginning in 1963, and they renewed a rivalry that had been proven successful in other territories. No surprise, it was also a smash in the Carolinas as well, and Crockett's fourth decade in promoting started out pretty well at the box office. But not everything was perfect. In fact, events would occur that would not only put Crockett's promotion in jeopardy, but endanger the entire National Wrestling Alliance. In 1956, the United States Attorney General announced that the Department of Justice would be bringing charges against the National Wrestling Alliance promoters, charging the group committed flagrant violations against the Sherman Act by engaging in practices that would, quote, restrain and monopolize the wrestling business, damaging both potential competition and contracted talent. While steadfastly declaring that no wrongdoing took place, the promoters promised to enter into a consent decree and shred the former bylaws that the alliance was founded on, change their business practices amongst each other, as well as the wrestlers that were at mercy for their employment. The promoters were warned that any entity found violating the decree could include being removed from the NWA and or face criminal charges. In the summer of 1959, William Bill Olivas, who was also known as Tony Olivas, although he'd be much better known in professional wrestling as the Elephant Boy, had inquired to Crockett and Lewis about the possibility of him promoting the triangle formed by the cities of Virginia Beach, Petersburg, and Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Unsurprisingly, the request was hand-waved away. Undeterred, Olivas went to the Virginia State Athletic Commission. He was told that no one had held any sort of exclusive rights anywhere and that he could apply for a license, although he had to be a resident of the state for at least a year. Not qualifying on the latter, Olivas was told by the same commissioner that anyone could apply for a booking agent or a manager's license. Using that angle, Olivas quickly assembled a booking license to run in nearly 20 cities, primarily on the Tidewater, and put in figurehead local promoters. He then went to work on acquiring talent and struck a deal with Dr. Jerry Graham. As Olivas would recount during interviews with the Federal Bureau of Investigation that were conducted in 1960, the former wrestler faced varying degrees of pushback from Crockett and Lewis. Olivas claimed that Lewis came to the hotel that he was staying at, banged on the door of his room yelling, "Elephant Boy, I know you're in there!" Another time, Olivas mentioned that he was, quote, confronted by a knife-wielding associate of Crockett who was trying to pressure him into abandoning his promotional plans, unquote. He wouldn't, and instead he landed a 13-week TV deal with a station in Norfolk. The knife-wielding assailant was Leo Voss, a Crockett referee. After Voss was arrested, Crockett tried to offer a settlement of a talent exchange that would see Charlotte send talent to Norfolk to work Olivas' television and even help promote his live events. Olivas was warned not to invest too heavily in the deal by several Crockett wrestlers, headed by Tom Renesto, saying that Crockett still had full intentions of freezing him out of the area. During the meeting that Crockett had with Olivas, the FBI alleged that the promoter asked Olivas, quote, "How's your mother's health?" as well as giving him money to, quote, "Head south and not come back, as I have no intention of fooling around with you anymore," unquote. Olivas would begin running his shows anyway, which then caused an issue with another Alliance member, this time from the North, the Capital Wrestling Corporation, and its founders Vince McMahon Sr. and Toots Mott. Jerry Graham was leaned on heavily to walk away from the Norfolk show, while Chief Little Eagle was immediately blacklisted by McMahon and Mott for appearing on it. Meanwhile, once Crockett caught wind of Danny McShane being booked by Olivas, he reportedly intervened in an attempt to get him booked elsewhere. With all of this swirling around, the Virginia State Athletic Commission held a hearing on November 25, 1959, to determine how they were going to proceed with the allegations. The FBI then stepped in and began an investigation process of their own, which included complaints from Baltimore promoter Ed Kantos Jr., who was also accusing Capital about monopolistic practices. After spending almost the entire year investigating the National Wrestling Alliance, conducting interviews and sifting through evidence, in November of 1960, the United States Department of Justice decided not to pursue litigation against Crockett, Lewis, Mott, McMahon, or anyone else involved in the NWA. But while they chose to not charge the four, they were found far from innocent. The FBI noted that six wrestlers, Joe Romero, Jean Madrid, John King, Jack London, Dick Bryant, a.k.a. Little Eagle, and Danny McShane were all blacklisted, and at least one official thought that moving forward could ultimately result in a slam dunk ruling. He stated, quote, "The facts fully indicate that there's been a deliberate violation of the judgment by Lewis, Crockett, and Mott with the aid and assistance of McMahon, who admittedly had full knowledge of the judgment. I am confident that a verdict of guilty can be obtained against Lewis and Crockett. The evidence against Mott and McMahon is weaker. The industry is not of too great importance or significance, economically it is true, but that very willfulness of the violation makes it significant, I believe, and one that we ought to bring." Technically, the feds ruled that Crockett, Lewis, McMahon, and Mott had to be removed from their positions for 6 months, but neither side of pro wrestling's Mason-Dixon line suffered. Joe Murnick was already working with Big Jim under a partnership known as CNM Promotions, but he would help to make sure that the far eastern portions of the territory on the Atlantic coastline would become bulletproof from competition, and business moved on. On November 23, 1961, 7 years after the death of Bobby Becker on Thanksgiving, Jim Crockett Sr. would begin to make wrestling on Thanksgiving an organized and lucrative annual tradition for the wrestling business when he held his first ever wrestling show to ever take place at the Greensboro Coliseum. The main event featured Argentina Rocca against Bob Orton and began a streak of the promotion running in Greensboro every third Thursday in November until infamously moving Starrcade to Chicago in 1987. For years, there would also be a live show that day in Norfolk, but that was absorbed into the Greensboro show as the Starrcade era came on. Also in 1961, Crockett made the decision to run on Christmas night, with the Park Center being the initial home for those shows. Once again, Rocca was imported in to face off against one of the promotion's top heels, Rip Hawk, with a semi-main event of George Becker against Angelo Sivoldi, as well as a women's bout and a midgets tag team match. The next year, the company ran both Raleigh and Columbia. The Christmas night extravaganzas gained incredible steam as years went on, often featuring a main event consisting of a fence match, aka the steel cage. Christmas Day would often turn into a three-town-a-day deal, sometimes in Norfolk, other times in Savannah, and often in Raleigh. Those shows would usually join Charlotte and Greenville as the places to be. The decision to bring in Argentina Rocca for those types of big holiday shows in the 1950s certainly opened the door of business, which would swing a very interesting way in 1963. Rocca had main evented every main event in Madison Square Garden between December 12, 1955 and January 23, 1961. He was the most prolific earner in the business between 1949 and 1963, and his legend to fans in New York was unquestioned. But time moves on, and other fresher faces move in. Men with names like Nature Boy Buddy Rogers and a burgeoning ethnic superstar named Bruno Sammartino. Those men began to overshadow the legendary Rocca, with that proof being evident at the box office. So, as he began to be shuffled out, it's no surprise that his relationship with the New York office disintegrated. After appearing on Capitol Wrestling's Bridgeport, Connecticut TV tapings to begin 1963, the two sides were finished with each other, and the Italian star began looking for other options. To show how quickly things changed in the wrestling world, the two entities that would be accused of conspiring with each other just 3 years earlier were about to be on very opposite sides. On January 24th in Toronto, Lou Thesz defeated Buddy Rogers in one fall to win the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. This is the symbolic day that the Worldwide Wrestling Federation was born, as promoters in the Northeast United States refused to recognize the title change, instead continuing to recognize the capital-booked Rogers as champion. With that, a wedge was divided in between the New York office and the NWA, which meant the relationship between McMahon and Crockett could change. While McMahon never cut ties with the group, in August, Crockett took over McMahon's position as the second vice president of the alliance. Rocca had reached out to Crockett to inquire about using him as a booking office to get opposition up and running, and the two sides worked out a deal. They brought in Sunnyside Gardens owner Manny Hecklin and secured the building in Queens as its home base. On the strength of Rocca's name, Crockett landed a live weekly television broadcast between 9:30 and 11 p.m. on future superstation WOR beginning on Monday, September 30th, 1963. The show was called All-Star Wrestling with Antonina Rocca and attempted to be competition with Bridgeport. Rocca appeared on the first episode defeating Jose Romano 2-1 and also featured a semi-main of Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen defeating Angelo Martinelli and Jesse James. Cowboy Bob Ellis, a former star in New York due to his matches against Buddy Rogers, was utilized on television and would soon become a Southern Tag Team Champion with Young Crockett star Johnny Weaver. The Gallagher brothers would become the first tag presence on the show, followed by Carl and Adolf Von Hess. While Rocca would build to matches with Man Mountain Cannon and Johnny Barron, as well as teaming with the future Mr. Wrestling 2 Johnny Walker at the end of the year. The venture would be a massive failure. Capitol had feuds that would culminate at Madison Square Garden and could utilize names like Rocca's ex-partner Miguel Perez, the Fabulous Kangaroos, Bobo Brazil, Killer Kowalski, and of course, Bruno Sammartino. The competition was too much to overcome, and the group would run its last show at the Sunnyside Gardens on January 13, 1964, and then get booted from the building after losing its television deal. As things atrophied, the Crockett talent stopped migrating north, leaving even slimmer pickings for Rocca. There would be shows run at the Bay Ridge Center and Singer Bowl, both in Queens, and the Armory in Paterson, New Jersey, but according to records, the promotion's swan song was June 15, 1964. Thankfully for Crockett, his home base was chugging along just grand, and that's where his focus would remain for the next decade. And top tag teams would continue to be the territory's meal ticket as dozens of Hall of Fame names came through or settled. Hawk and Hansen, P.Y. Chung and Haru Sasaki, the Infernos with J.C. Dykes, Chris and John Tolos, Bronco Lubitsch and Aldo Bogni with Homer Odell, Brute Bernard and the Missouri Mauler, Pampo Furpo and Missouri Mauler, Nelson Royal and Paul Jones, Gene and Ole Anderson, Jack and Jerry Briscoe, and of course, George Becker and Johnny Weaver. George Becker was tabbed as the man to put the Pacific Coast version of the world title on so that Enrique Torres could take it away from him in 1946. That's where he began teaming with his kayfabe brother Bobby before moving into the Carolinas, where they would both become an institution under Big Jim. Although Bobby tragically passed away, George went along and actually became the booker in the area and became trusted with getting over new stars such as Weaver. Weaver would go on to follow in Becker's footsteps as a booker and a guide for younger talent years later under Jim Crockett Jr. Counts vary, but Becker had about 23 Southern Tag Team and 4 Atlantic Coast Tag Team title reigns. Sadly, on Friday, March 30th, 1973, Big Jim Crockett was admitted to a hospital with breathing difficulties and would pass away on April 1st, 1973, at the age of 63. Son-in-law John Ringley took over Crockett Promotions and began to usher in the changes that would set the company up and take their business to a different level throughout the mid-1970s, including the idea to change the name of the promotion and the title to Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, bringing in George Scott as a booker, and advocating for the philosophical switch in booking from tag teams to singles, which of course ushered in the era of Johnny Valentine and Wahoo McDaniel. And then an extramarital affair caused Ringley to be exiled from the company, and he divorced Jim's daughter, Frances. When that occurred, Crockett's eldest son, 28-year-old Jim Jr., would ascend to the head of the promotion and continue to run it for 25 years until it was sold to Turner Broadcasting in 1988. When Crockett passed away, the Charlotte Observer's obituary overflowed with praise for the man, noting how important the perception was that he was never above the people he was trying to entice. As written by Susan Jetton. Quote, Crockett drove comfortable automobiles, but he would pale at the sight of a Cadillac salesman. He'd explain, it's a great car, but I don't want my customers to see me driving to the show looking like a fat cat. Not when they're having problems digging up $1.50 for a balcony seat. The Crockett empire grew hard on business facts, an ear to the public pulse, and a baker's honesty. Said Jim, if you promise them Andy Williams for 2 hours, make sure Andy's out there early and see that he doesn't leave for 122 minutes, unquote. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that little bio on Jim Crockett Sr., one of the newest inductees into the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. And this look at Crockett would not have been possible without the great research of folks like Dick Bourne, Dave Chappell, Mark Eastridge, Carol W. Hall, Jim Zordani, Jim Wilson, Weldon T. Johnson, Barry Rose, Tim Hornbaker, and many, many others. For more information on Jim Crockett Sr., head over to the MidAtlanticGateway.com where they have plenty of features on him as well as all of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling from over the years. Just a wonderful site that this show would just not be able to do without. Just a wonderful bunch of people over there. For more information about the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, go over to F4WOnline.com or WrestlingObserver.com and find out who you could be a subscriber there and check out some of the great historical stuff that Dave Meltzer has penned in the past, including all of those editions of the annual Hall of Fame issue that every year gets us all up in a flutter and doing shows like over at 605pod.com, where many of us here at the Arcadian Vanguard chip in and banter about who we think should be in or shouldn't be in to the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. And as I mentioned earlier on, we will be back next week reviewing episodes of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling as they appear on the WWE Network. Until then, my name is Mike Sempervivi. The Mid-Atlantic Championship Podcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And it's not a goodbye until Bob Cottle tells you this.
And that'll do it for this week. See you next week. And until then, so long for now.